This mini lecture for English 206 will take you through English literary history in 10 minutes or so. Now, one thing to keep in mind about this, what this narrative represents is what could be considered the standard party line of English literary history. A number of these points are going to be fairly controversial to people who know a lot about the field. A number of these things may very well raise questions, even for people who don't know a huge amount about English literary history. But this is the traditional kind of received way that the history of English literature is generally talked about following traditional period markers. The first period to know about in English literary history is the medieval. This is actually a very long period. It began sometime back in the mists of time, maybe around the 8th century, as the Angles and the Saxons began to move into Britain in the wake of the Romans leaving it. The Celts were already there, but we're not really going to talk about them too much. What we do want to talk about in terms of Angles and Saxons is that they developed a style of poetry that became influential much, much later on. They wrote Beowulf as the great monument of their culture, but also works like The Dream of the Rood, The Wanderer, The Seafarer. The Venerable Bede, as a historian of this time, is very well known. And as the period progressed past, say, the year 1000, 1066 was the year that the Normans from France invaded England, and the language and the literature began to change at that point. Some warrior culture survived from before, but much of it was replaced by courtly romances from France, stories of King Arthur and Lancelot, stories of Guinevere, stories such as Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, which is based on the Arthurian cycles. And the greatest of these medieval writers was Geoffrey Chaucer, writing things like the Canterbury Tales, a collection of stories drawn from folklore, from classical literature, from many, many different sources, giving something of the breadth of English society at the time, as well as European literary tastes. Then later on, you move into the Renaissance. This is around 1485. That's usually the date cut off because that's the year of the Battle of Bosworth Field. That's the battle that's credited with bringing the War of the Roses to the end, with the defeat of Richard III and the accession of Henry VII to the throne as the first Tudor monarch, leading on the line of Henry VIII, Elizabeth I, who preside over the English Protestant Reformation, as well as the rise of great poets such as Edmund Spenser, Thomas Wyatt, Philip Sidney. Spenser most famous for The Faerie Queen, which is dedicated to and in some ways patterned on Elizabeth, but also the rise of what's considered the golden age of English theater in Christopher Marlowe and William Shakespeare. A little bit later on, people like Ben Jonson as we start to get into the 1600s. And around the middle of the 1600s, literature goes into sort of a lull, and this is because of the English Civil War, which rages across the 1630s into the early 1640s. The king, Charles I, is beheaded in the process, and a republican government, what is often referred to as an interregnum, is set up at this point. The next major period defining date is 1660, the year that Charles's son, Charles II, becomes king of England. At this point, many of the Puritans who were on the winning side of the Civil War had to go into exile. This included John Milton, who wrote his epic Paradise Lost while in exile. But this also started to generate new interest in poetry of the court, whether it was ribald poetry like the Earl of Rochester, whether it was classically informed poetry that had very strong meter and rhyme and decorum, coming from people like John Dryden. And you also had a renewed interest in theater by the end of the century with people like William Congreve, as well as the beginning of the emergence of what we now call the novel. Works like Offa Baine's Orinoco come out of that. Baine was actually most famous as a theater writer significantly. But then soon after that, works like Defoe's Robinson Crusoe, Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels in the 1710s started to mark the beginning of what we think of as the history of modern fiction. At the same time, Swift, as well as people like Alexander Pope, were writing very classically informed, very measured verse, patterned somewhat on Dryden, on other imitators of the classics. And this continued on as the standard of taste through most of the century, where the novel is beginning to rise while poetry keeps its very classical form. And everything kind of explodes in the late 1700s into what is now referred to as the Romantic era. This is where the idea of the individual genius starts to become much more important than ideas of imitation and good form. This is where fiction starts to take on much more Gothic elements. Think of Shelley's Frankenstein, for instance, from the 18-teens. Poetry turns to landscape, turns to nature, also turns to the Gothic to some extent, and you have writers like William Wordsworth, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who are drawing on folklore as well as landscapes of rural Britain and elsewhere. Later on, you have more politically radical writers such as Percy Shelley and Lord Byron, who are trying to write the poetry of liberty for the new century. John Keats is also in that same generation. He's more focused on finding his own personal responses to the classical tradition rather than try to fit into received culture of that sort. Following on this tradition, we get the Victorian era, where a number of major geniuses, major figures start to emerge, writers like Thomas Carlyle, Matthew Arnold, John Ruskin, who are all essayists at this point. But then you also have the great age of the novel, interestingly not really represented in anthologies because they're too long to anthologize. People like Dickens, George Eliot, William Makepeace Thackeray, these kinds of writers are moving into prominence during the Victorian era. And poets such as Robert Browning, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, and perhaps preeminently Alfred Lord Tennyson are the main figures of this time, who, again, try to find a middle ground between turning to ancient traditions and expressing the personal. These two traditions will keep continuing to vie with each other toward the end of the century, when we start to see the rise of people who identify themselves as highly realistic writers, people like Thomas Hardy, Joseph Conrad, but also very private poets, such as Gerard Manley Hopkins. This leads into the modernist era, where that realism starts to give way to a sense of disillusionment, a sense of the fracturing of the world. This is where the Bloomsbury group, headed by people like Virginia Woolf, come into play with stream of consciousness narrative, James Joyce in Dublin participating in the same kind of experiments. In writing, or in poetry rather, there is a focus on the image through people like T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound, who are Americans who identify themselves with England and with Europe as this new cosmopolitan generation. Modernism lasts more or less up to the Second World War, and that is often seen as the dividing line between modernism and postmodernism, as the disillusionment from the war, the new ideas introduced by British soldiers serving all around the world start to bring in many other cultures, as well as the dissolution of the empire as more and more countries declare independence. We start to see English language writers emerging from many other parts of the world. Salman Rushdie from India being a prime example, from Africa, Chinua Achebe, J.M. Coetzee, from the Caribbean, Derek Walcott, V.S. Naipaul, and the list goes on and on. So that as you look at the later years of the Norton Anthology's English Literature Collection, there's actually less and less coming from England. Even a number of the people who we might identify as British, Seamus Heaney, Evan Boland, these kinds of writers, Paul Muldoon, are all Irish writers. And in fact, one could say that where English literature ends up by the 21st century is around the globe in a way that the empire always imagined that the homeland English literature would spread around the world, and indeed it did. Now that literature, though, seems to be coming back to the home country, and English literature is now a world phenomenon.